Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Maeve McClenaghan, and this is The Tip-Off. On this podcast, we take you behind the scenes of some of the UK's best investigative journalism. Episode by episode, we'll be digging into an amazing investigative scoop, hearing from the journalists behind the work as they tell us about the leads, the dead ends, and how they got their story out. Picture the scene. It's a rainy winter morning, and Jane Bradley is stood on a doorstep in West London. At her feet is a garden gnome, another clue in a puzzle she is unravelling. She is about to knock and tell a mother that she suspects her son is one of the world's most wanted terrorists. But that comes later. As ever, it starts with a tip-off.
Obama, have yet again, from your actions, killed yet another American citizen, so just as your missiles continue to strike.
In 2014, the filmed murder of journalist James Foley shook the world. Little was known publicly of his executioner, a masked man speaking in a British accent, who became dubbed as Jihadi John. Until...
The man in the mask is one of the world's most wanted, and now authorities know his name.
A story broke in the Washington Post. Journalist Adam Goldman had discovered the man's identity.
Okay, well, this originally began when Jim Comey said that he knew the identity of Jihadi John.
You have a name?
I have it in my head.
But you're not willing to share it?
I am not.
My editors said, well, if Comey knows the name, then you should be able to get the name. So for months and months and months, we pieced together Jihadi John's identity.
Jihadi John was Mohammed Emwazi. Born in Kuwait, he'd moved to the UK when he was 6 years old, grew up in West London, and studied IT at the University of Westminster before moving to Syria. But Emwazi did not work alone. His nickname, Jihadi John, had been born from the fact that he was one of a group of notoriously cruel ISIS jailers, nicknamed by their captors as the Beatles because of their British accents. The four men were collectively responsible for beheading 27 hostages and torturing captives with electric shocks, waterboarding, and mock executions.
I had to learn about him. We tried to learn about his fellow Beatles. But we only came up in the end with Jihadi John's name.
So even with Emwazi unmasked, the rest of that horrifically cruel group were still unknown. Who and where were Paul, George, and Ringo? Journalists around the world raced to unmask their true identities, including Jane Bradley.
My name is Jane Bradley, and I am an investigations correspondent at BuzzFeed News, based in London.
But how do you go about tracking down some of the world's most wanted men? This is the story of how Jane did it not once, but twice. Like any good investigation, it started with a tip-off. Jane was working at her desk in BuzzFeed's central London office, just off Oxford Street, when one day her editor called her over and said she had a tip for her.
I remember just thinking, this is huge.
Adam Goldman had been in touch. Fresh on the heels of his scoop about Jihadi John, he had been passed another name. A name that supposedly could unmask another of the Beatles' terror cell, the captor known as Ringo.
I believe I first learned Cote's name from a former hostage, in fact. A former hostage held in Syria knew the name of Kote.
But as tips go, it wasn't a lot of information.
Two very kind of vague pieces of information. One was that this guy's name was Alexander Kote, and he gave us a spelling which later turned out to be completely incorrect. And the other was that he was friends or a contact with Mohammed Amwazi, the guy from West London who was featured in all the ISIS propaganda videos. So he also said he was mixed race. You know, we were in the midst of all the coverage about Jihadi John, Mohammed Amwazi, and I knew that kind of the world's intelligence services, certainly the West intelligence services, were on the hunt for these men. And nobody knew who they were. I knew journalists were all trying to find out who they were. So I kind of knew immediately how big the story would be.
So she had a name, Alexei Kote, though how that was spelt was anyone's guess, and a hint that he might have family from Ghana. But a name is not enough. For one thing, there could be any number of people with that name. And what was his story? How did he end up getting involved in something so horrifying? With an allegation so serious, Jane was going to have to be 100% sure she had the right person. The name was a start, but Jane had no idea where it would lead. So she began by searching everywhere she could online for that name.
So there was one clue we found, which proved quite vital in the investigation, and that was an old Ask FM transcript of an interview with Ringo. And in it, he kind of gave a couple of clues as to his identity. One was that he was a QPR fan. Two was that he was as British as they come.
QPR, Queen's Park Rangers, a football team based in West London. Okay, he's a football fan, but that doesn't get her closer to finding his true identity.
So the next thing we did is I looked up all the different spellings of the name Alexander Kote.
Jane spent days running different spellings of the name through every online database she could find. And then she got a match. At least, it could have been a match. But there was something not quite right.
The name was listed as a woman. So it was Miss Alexander Kote.
A woman? That couldn't be right. But she was curious, and it was the best lead she had. So Jane packed up her notebook and headed out to the address listed next to that name.
So I went down to this area of West London with my colleague Richard Holmes, and we waited all day outside the address. And then I'd initially knocked on the door, no one was in. But what I'd noticed was on the doorstep was a QPR gnome.
Could this be it? Was Jane about to come face to face with the family of one of the world's most wanted men? Or was she about to meet a Miss Kote, some innocent woman with no connection to the story at all?
So I went up to the door and I knocked. And initially, the person I now know as a stepdad answered the door. And my opening gambit was, "Hi, could I speak to Alexander Kote?" And he was kind of friendly, but a bit quizzical. "Alexander Kote, Alexander Kote." And he was like, "I don't think I know an Alexander Kote." And then the mum came out, and the mum was having none of it. As soon as she came to the door, she said, "Why are you asking, who are you?" And then obviously I said, "I'm a journalist from BuzzFeed News." And she said, "I cannot help you," and went to close the door. It was an instant kind of shutting down.
A dead end. But something didn't feel right.
Their attitude was really unusual. I've done a lot of doorsteps, and it's not unusual for someone to tell you to go away and close the door in your face. But what was unusual was that they seemed to know why I was there before I even had time to explain it.
Jane's editors suggested she drop the story. She'd spent weeks on it, but to no avail. Perhaps Adam Goldman's source was completely mistaken. But something in the way the woman at the door had acted was playing on her mind. And Jane's not one to give up. Jane went back to the drawing board. Convinced she was on the right track, she turned to a database of company ownership records called Company's House. She started to run the name through those records. Time after time, it came up the same.
He was listed as a miss again.
But on she searched, until finally she came to a company incorporation document. That's a piece of paperwork which requires the applicant to fill in the form by hand.
And on that record, it said Mr. Alexander Coty. So this was really interesting because every electronic record had said it was a woman. But the handwritten record, the one that couldn't theoretically be changed or edited, said Mr.
So she had him. According to this document, Alexei Coty was a man after all. And then she had another breakthrough.
I went back onto TraceIQ and I managed to get the birth certificate for Alexander Coty just to confirm. I wanted to confirm, first of all, that it was a man. Definitely, it wasn't kind of a typo or handwriting error. And then I really wanted to find out. So the birth certificate gives you information about the parents and the parents' heritage and kind of what job they did and where they were from, their nationality. So I eventually got the birth certificate back. And it came back, confirmed he was male. Not only that, but his father was Ghanaian. So he was mixed race and he was from Ghana.
Keen to check she was on the right track, Jane would check in with Adam Goldman and he would relay the snippets of information to his intelligence sources for confirmation.
It was pretty clear to me that she found him. You know, my job was just to try to feed her more information, right? She would get an age, then I'd go back and I'd poke around and say, is that age right? You know, yes, he's 27, he's 26, that DOB's right.
But a simple miscommunication almost threw them both off.
I think one time I had a DOB reversed, but it was the British DOB. And then we realized, right, that when I went to the Americans with the British date of birth, because I think your day comes, doesn't your day come first? Yeah. So, right, I almost threw it off. And then I realized, no, wait, no, it's true the other way.
Differences in British-US dates aside, Jane was now feeling pretty confident she had the right guy. The next thing was to go and get confirmation that he had gone to Syria. And the only way to do that was through people who knew him.
So what I did is on the company's house documents, it listed his business partner. So I found the home address of this business partner. I didn't want to give too much away because A, it wasn't confirmed that he was a terrorist, and to go around saying, oh, we think this guy's a terrorist without knowing or at least being confident in it would have been unfair to him. So I just said, we're looking to get in touch with him for a potential story, but it was too sensitive to explain in detail what it was. And then he said, well, I haven't seen him in years, not really since he converted to Islam when he was in his early 20s. So that fitted another part of the picture we were looking at. But he said, anyway, I can't really tell you very much about him. I knew his brother better. And I said, oh, who's his brother? And he gave me the name. And he said, oh, I'm looking at him on LinkedIn now.
Now the pieces started to fall into place. One contact would lead her to another and on and on.
And his brother's Facebook profile had a public friends list. So what I did then was to basically go through every single friend on his friend list and family member and contact them. And I must have messaged easily 300 people, easily. Most of them didn't reply. Some of them replied, said, I can't help you. But then one guy did reply and he said, yeah, let me call you. I'll tell you about him. So anyway.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But he gave me a call. It turned out that he grew up with Alexei and knew that he had converted to Islam and said that he'd become radicalised at a local mosque.
After speaking to several people who knew Kote, Jane finally felt confident that she had the right guy. His family history matched the information the former hostage had given, and Kote's old friends confirmed that he had travelled to Syria. Other friends passed on photographs and filled her in on how he had grown from a football-loving West London boy to a radicalised jihadi killer. She was ready to publish, but there were so many times the investigation could have been stopped in its tracks.
It almost scares me to think about that, because honestly, if his family, if his parents had been better liars, then I would have gone away. But I think that shows, A, the importance of your instinct as a journalist, and B, is just that kind of doggedness, that not giving up. Like, I could have easily have just been like, right, that's it. My editors would have understood. They weren't pushing anymore. But it's just kind of keep half the time getting the story, just keeping going when other people have stopped. That's half the battle.
She didn't know it then, but Jane would keep going still. She was about to find yet another of the Beatles' terror cell. She would soon be on the hunt for the man known as George. Stay tuned for part two, as Jane finds herself breaking some terrible news to a bereft mother. Back in Washington, and Adam Goldman is having lunch with a former U.S. official.
Out of the blue, I just asked him, hey, do you know who the Beatles are? And he knew about Chicago. So it was just a coincidence. We were having lunch, and I would always ask people. Whenever I met with people I thought who might know, I'd ask them. And he happened to know the name. He had a pretty good memory.
The name was El-Shafi El-Sheikh. According to this intelligence officer, he was the member of the terror cell known as George. Adam passed it on to Jane, and she got to work. This time Jane was able to track the family down a lot quicker. Shafi's name had been in the press before, though he hadn't been linked to the Beatles' terror cell. So just a few days after her first story broke, Jane found herself back in West London, about to do another doorstep.
I'd driven there, taken out a hire car, and I'd just gone by myself, parked up, and just rehearsed in my mind my opening gambit and how it's going to try and get her in. It was raining, which you might think is actually bad, but often it gets you sympathy on door knocks.
Jane had done plenty of doorstep knocks before, but standing there in the rain, she still felt nervous.
I think I still always get a bit of nerves on a door knock, especially because generally the door knocks that I do, that most investigative journalists do, it's not good news. So you're either approaching somebody to ask them to talk about something really difficult and personal, or you're confronting them with allegations. So I think it's natural to feel nervous in that situation. And I think the key things when you are doing the door knock is, for me, I kind of have my initial approach almost mapped out in my head. I know the first kind of few phrases I'm going to open with.
Last time she had been in this situation, she'd had a door slammed in her face, and her investigation had been all but derailed. Pulling herself together, she knocked.
So I knocked on the door and her friend answered. And I just said, I'm here to speak to Al-Shafi al-Sheikh's mother. So I walked in, and it was kind of, the hallway was lined with family photographs of Al-Shafi, but also what I now know as his brothers. So I came in the living room where she was sat in her big white armchair, and she was a frail, tiny, tiny woman, I think in her 60s, 70s. And I came around and just said, you know, I'm Jane, I'm here from BuzzFeed. And like I said, I'm here to talk to you about your son's radicalization. I know it's going to be difficult. And pretty much at that point, she just burst into tears, like completely broke down. So obviously that confirmed to me it was definitely the right address and the right person. And it's kind of that difficult line when you're a journalist about being sympathetic but not fake, but also what would your natural human reaction be if somebody sat there in tears in front of you? So I kind of grabbed her hand and reassured her and said I was really sorry. I was here to talk about something so difficult, but it was important. And she kind of, it just all came out. And she started just sobbing and telling me a story and how he was such a good boy and how helpless she felt when he was becoming radicalized, because as a single mum, she couldn't have access to the mosque he was radicalized at. She felt completely disconnected. And just describing kind of the change in his attitude over a period of a year, she said it was lightning fast, his radicalization.
Was she aware that her son was one of those four, or was it just that she thought he had gone off to Syria?
Well, this was a really difficult thing. She was aware he'd gone off to Syria, but she had no idea what he was doing over there. In fact, she thought, because he was such kind of a mechanical engineering genius, she said to me, you know, I'm sure they just used him for him to fix cars and machinery. That's what he's being used for. She kind of, I don't think she could comprehend that he was carrying out executions and was one of the kind of the key guards of this internationally wanted terrorist cell.
My kids were perfect, she told Jane, a look of total incomprehension on her face. And one day it suddenly happened. In her article, Jane would describe the woman as small and delicate, swamped in an oversized grey wool jumper and long dark skirt. She gives the impression of having sunk somewhere deep inside herself, Jane wrote.
Breaking that news to her was it's one of the hardest things I've had to do as a journalist. And she just started going, no, not Al-Shafi, not Al-Shafi, not my son. And just absolutely breaking and rocking on her chair and clutching her tissue and just absolutely like head in her hands. I've never seen someone just look whose grief was just so raw. And her friend came running in the room, into the living room, and kind of she managed through sobs to kind of explain what I told her. And her friend just grabbed her by the shoulders and said, this is not your fault. You are only his mum. This is not your fault. And thank God her friend calmed her down in a way that I couldn't have done. And she then kind of quietened down, stopped sobbing and just said, if that is my son, he is no longer my son. That's not what I brought him up to be. That's not who he is. He's not my son.
Shaken by the encounter, Jane headed back to the office to write up the story. A few days later, it was published. The story shook the world again, and Jane soon heard from Al-Shafi's mother.
Yeah, so she called me the morning the story was published, and she was obviously upset, but she said, thank you, you've done a good job. You've told his story and who he is. To hear that as a journalist was just, when you were telling such a difficult story for her, was just so overwhelming, and I was so pleased that she was kind of as happy as she could be with it.
In the space of just a few months, Jane had identified and unmasked two of the world's most wanted criminals. It was a kind of scoop most journalists would work their whole careers for. I asked Jane how she had felt before publishing both momentous stories.
I was incredibly nervous, and I think every half-decent investigative journalist has those nerves and those kind of, I don't know if second thoughts is the right word, but you start to question everything you know, and you're like, God, is it definitely this guy? You know, it is the photo. We confirmed it with enough people. Are the intelligence sources definitely right? And you always have these thoughts going through your head. So it's such a huge story. And kind of obviously the thing that's at the forefront of your mind is if you are wrong, you're exposing this family to all this media spotlight and all this kind of public judgment for something that might not be true. So you have to be 100% sure in your journalism, especially if something that kind of affects someone's life so much. Generally, excited that would come so far, but more than that, nervous, to be honest. I mean, that story ended up on every single front page in the UK, every single national newspaper in the UK.
It was a brilliant jigsawing together of various bits of this tapestry that built into an incredibly rich picture. The work was also a prime example of collaboration between two newsrooms, with Adam Goldman feeding leads and confirming Jane's progress.
It was a really great collaboration because neither of us could have done the story without the other. So we didn't have the intelligence sources, which Adam had, and Adam didn't have kind of the expertise or ability to do the door knocks in London or trace all the public records. So we both credited each other in the investigation. It was a joint investigation, very much so, and it worked out incredibly well.
But the journey was a long one, and for a while it had looked like the story was slipping through her fingers. I asked Jane, when was the moment she knew she'd got the story? What was the moment along that journey when you thought, aha, I've got you? That you were like 99% sure that this was the guy.
The birth certificate. Yeah, the birth certificate was a key bit where I was like, got you. So that was when I thought, right, this story's got legs, we can tell it.
In May this year, the final alleged member of the Beatles cell, Ayn Davis, was convicted of terrorism in a Turkish court. Jihadi John, or Mohammed Emwazi, was reportedly killed in a drone strike earlier last year. But no one knows the current whereabouts of either Alexei Kote or El Shafi El Sheikh. Thanks to Jane's reporting, both men can no longer hide behind the mask of anonymity. And the work sparked an important debate about how young British men come to be radicalised. Like the best kind of journalism, it shone a light into dark corners and revealed the troubled young men behind the monsters. That's all from this week's episode. Next time.
You're basically paying £264 a week to kill me. I think that was really, in one quote, how she felt about where she was living.
Emma Yule tells us how she spent a year exposing appalling living conditions right in the heart of London. This has been a tip-off, hosted and produced by me, Maeve McLennigan, with production advice from Lorna Stewart. Our theme music is by Dice Muse. Thanks to Jane Bradley. As always, you can find a link to her story in the show notes. If you've liked this episode, please do tell a friend, write us a review on iTunes, and stay tuned for more stories behind the headlines.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.